What Witch, This, That, or the Other? From Bonnaroo to Coachella, traversing the music festival landscape can be tricky. That's where we come in with high fives for everyone. The What Podcast with Brad Barry, Lord Taco, dedicated to exploring the entire festival scene.
Brad has worked in the radio industry for more than 20 years and currently lives in Brooklyn, where he is program director for three stations, including one in New York, one in Detroit, and one in Miami.
Barry's been a reporter for the Chattanooga Times Free Press, covering all aspects of the entertainment industry since 1987. That's before you were born.
Lord Taco, the smart guy who makes these podcasts on our website at thewhatpodcast.com work, also really good at identifying babies, loves blue-haired moms, PBR, and his beautiful Volkswagen bus.
We all fell in love with the Bonnaroo Festival years ago, not only because of the amazing bands that play there every year, but also because of the incredible community spirit that has developed around it. Radiate positivity.
And we really like talking about the inside baseball stuff when it comes to putting on a huge music festival. So join us.
You can hear the What Podcast on the Consequence Podcast Network or anywhere you find your favorite podcasts.
In 2015, music journalist Kenneth Partridge did the impossible. He published a long-form think piece about ska on Pitchfork. This article, called Remembering the Real Lessons of Two-Tone Ska, came after Kenneth, a lifelong ska fan, noticed that several two-tone bands were suddenly releasing new albums. He thought this was a great opportunity to analyze two-tone's legacy and discuss how it was very different from the 90s U.S. ska scene he was a part of as a teenager. After the article published, Kenneth, our guest today, continued to think about these differences, specifically what the legacy of 90s American ska was, why it was so different than two-tone, and if it deserved respect on its own terms. His new book, Hell of a Hat, The Rise of 90s Ska and Swing, is the result of this journey. Today we discuss Kenneth's book and ask the big question, why did he also include swing?
So when you wrote your ska book, turns out there are other people in other places in the world having the same idea to write a book about ska, and Kenneth is one of them.
Yep. There was me, Mark Wasserman, and Kenneth Partridge.
So this is going to cause a little bit of like East Coast, West Coast rivalry, right?
No. We're all friends. We're all on the same page of pushing, you know, ska into culture and defending ska in our own ways. So, you know, hey, everyone else out there, if you want to write a ska book, come join.
When you told me about Ken's book, Hell of a Hat, that it dealt with ska and swing, I was like, wait. We're going to lump in the like 3-month period that swing had a moment with the ska scene. So yeah. that was the first thing I felt like we needed to talk about when we talked to Ken.
Yeah. And it turns out we're kind of like the ignorant ska people that we are always talking about when it comes to swing, because swing's history is actually a little different than we assumed it was.
Right. Our perception of it is very similar to how the rest of the world perceives the 90s ska boom.
Yes, which I guess is why he lumped them together.
He was onto something after all.
You got 5 minutes. I want you to defend swing right now.
I'm going to need at least 9 minutes to defend swing.
Take all the time you need, but defend swing for me.
I was like, wait, there was actually a swing scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I see what you're saying. It's a hard thing to defend as far as some people are concerned. I think that it got actually like a worse name than ska. I'd be sort of curious to hear what you guys think about that. But
1,000%.
Yeah.
Your book definitely softened some of my views on swing. Although I have like typically liked to use swing as an example to show what ska isn't. Because in my mind, like, ska often gets framed as a trend that sort of came and went. To mainstream eyes, that's what ska was in the 90s. And it's like, you go, no, that's not at all what ska was. Ska had been, not only did ska have this long history starting from Jamaica, but even in the US, it had had a pretty prominent place since the early 80s. And it was a fraction of the bands that existed were the ones that were in the spotlight. Whereas
swing was more like what people think ska was, or that's kind of been my view, and that's been my argument that I've made with people as I've defended ska.
Yeah.
So it's your turn to defend swing.
Yeah, well, the thing that I would say is that I think all of the bands that got sort of popular in the swing moment of 98, like, had actually been around for a long time. It wasn't like they were a bunch of like bandwagon jumpers. You know, it was like Royal Crown Revue had been around since, you know, like 89. You had, you know, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy was since like, you know, 92, 93. You know, Cherry Pop and Daddies had been, you know, since like the 80s also, you know, playing all different styles, obviously, not just, you know, swing. They played ska, they played, you know, funk rock, they played, like, you know, pretty much everything that you could imagine. Brian Setzer too, since like, you know, the early 90s. So yeah, I think because of like, you know, the Gap commercial and a couple of like the movies that came out, it was more of like a flash in the pan kind of thing. And I think that's what kind of turned people off to it. But I think it had a lot of the same characteristics as ska, in that it was this pretty like organic, like underground, you know, movement that had a lot of ex-punk rockers that were part of it. And it wasn't, you know, I could definitely see how it like ended up looking, you know, very corny to like, you know, people afterwards, certainly. But I think it didn't like necessarily start out that way. And, you know, well, I should say from the, you know, just kind of like off the bat too, that I was much more of a ska kid, like when I was growing up in the 90s. Like I liked some of the swing bands, but I wasn't like, I didn't know how to dance or anything. I didn't really go to any swing shows because there weren't really like any local, you know, swing bands where I'm from. And, kind of like outside of Hartford, Connecticut, but there was like a million ska bands. So I was definitely like a hardcore ska kid.
My impression, because I wasn't really paying attention to swing, but I knew Cherry Pop and Daddies because they were a little bit more closer into the ska scene, because they played ska, funk, and like you said, they sort of played everything. And I saw them play in 92 as an opening band for Skank and Pickle. And they wore t-shirts. They just looked like dudes, just regular dudes, kind of shoved on the stage with barely enough room for them. And I liked it. I bought their tape. You know, I was like, this is pretty cool. Then it's just like, I saw them on MTV, all suited up with Zoot Suit Riot. And so to me, that was like, oh my God, here you have this band that's like, just like punk rock dudes in shirts kind of playing all this stuff, and all of a sudden they're a quote unquote swing band. That was sort of how it looked to me, but I know that's not really the story.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, as far back as their first album, they had like swing songs that kind of sounded, you know, quite a bit like the ones that they would, you know, then make them popular about a decade later. But yeah, there's a funny story about, because yeah, like they all used to just wear like whatever they wanted to on stage, and they played with the Boss Tones one time. I think this is in the book, Dickie Barrett like saw them, and he's like, you know, like, you guys look like you're a bunch of shipwreck victims. Like, you need to pull it together and, you know, wear like some nicer clothes. And, you know, I think they kind of took that to heart. But yeah, the story of kind of how they like went from playing all different styles to being a swing band in the late 90s is, it was just kind of a weird thing where they were on tour, and like people would always come up to the merch booth and they would want to know like which of the albums had the most swing songs on them. And at some point their manager was like, well, you know, like, why don't we just, you know, take all the swing songs from all of our records that have been out so far, like put a couple of new songs on it, and we would have, you know, something that people would like be really into. And, you know, they had no idea that it was going to blow up the way that it did, but just, I think it just came along at the right moment.
I think it's interesting because there was less swing bands, you know, like as opposed to the ska scene. The ska scene was this really eclectic thing that it seemed like, you know, the major labels sort of cherry picked bands that they felt comfortable marketing. With the swing bands, there wasn't a lot of bands. And, you know, like you said, they all started off, you know, in their respective scenes. But it seems like each of the big five ones had a different reference point. Like that some place that they were coming from and what they were going for was all kind of different.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's definitely true. Yeah. They weren't all the same, certainly. I mean, like, you know, Brian Setzer had like the big band, and, you know, they had like, I don't know, they had like, you know, 15 or 16 people in that group. And that like sounded totally different than, you know, Royal Crown, who were like all over the place in terms of, they would do like jump blues, but then they would play really weird jazz stuff. And I mean, that band was probably the most, like, you know, punk rock, but also the most jazz at the same time, if that makes sense. Like, they were like, you know, kind of by all accounts, like, that was the band that really like ought to have gotten the most attention, but it just didn't really work out for them, you know, quite that way.
Yeah. And then, and like you were talking about a Squirrel Neck Zippers basically being not so much a swing band as they were categorized, but more of a band that was just really into music that occurred pre-40s.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. They kind of played like, you know, like hot jazz and, you know, yeah. I mean, kind of like everything that was like leading up to swing in a way. And then, yeah. I mean, I guess they had some songs that, you know, kind of swung in like a musical sense. So like the, you know, dancers could still go see them and, you know, the media kind of lumped them in. But yeah, I think I just put them in the book just because, you know, they were definitely categorized as a swing band and they, you know, had some of the same characteristics, but, you know, certainly they were on their own trip for sure.
I remember it kind of blew my mind when I looked in the liner notes for the Squirrel Nut Zippers album. You can see there's a live shot and the drummer's wearing a Black Flag shirt.
Yeah.
Like everything about that record is like so retro and so like of a certain time period. And then he's wearing a Black Flag shirt. It was like the weirdest thing to me.
Yeah, I think it just goes to show that at some point all these guys were punks, you know, at some point, like in the 80s.
I remember having been just writing about music for the last decade, realizing that Jimbo, is that his name? Jimbo?
Yeah.
What's his last name?
Jimbo Mathis.
Jimbo Mathis. His music career post Squirrel Nut Zippers has kind of veered more towards Americana and roots music in a more overt way, like not in a big band type way. So what I was saying is, as a music journalist, in the last decade, I've kind of come across that, and it's given me a little insight into what Squirrel Nut Zippers were actually about.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point because yeah, their stuff was kind of just like weird Americana. Like the, you know, Squirrel Nut Zippers stuff had like a lot of blues in it and like some, you know, country elements. And yeah, I mean, you know, Jimbo was this guy who was from the South and had this, you know, crazy rural upbringing. And, you know, I think he worked on like oil barges at one point. Like he was like, you know, kind of this like eccentric, you know, Southern character. That really comes across in their songs for sure.
In the book you said, and I wasn't aware of this, that the swing albums, they sold more records. It was actually kind of a bigger thing than ska was, even mainstream ska.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at, you know, A Cherry Pop and Daddies, I think went double platinum with Zoot Suit Riot. You know, Squirrel Nut Zippers went platinum and Big Bad Voodoo Daddy also went platinum. Whereas like on the ska side, you can look at, you know, there's like, you know, Tragic Kingdom, obviously, has sold like 10 million copies or something. And then, you know, the Boss Tones went platinum with Let's Face It. But, you know, beyond that, there weren't really any, like, you know, even like in A Real Big Fish only sold, like, I think that went gold. But, you know, I mean, it wasn't like they were going platinum either.
Some of those bands, yeah, you're right. Like Real Big Fish, their name gets thrown around a lot and everyone knows their name, but they weren't quite as big as people think they were.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, like their songs are like super memorable. So you kind of, you know, think of them just because, I mean, they weren't doing Boss Tones numbers or anything like that.
And they have the longevity, but they've maintained it over the years where they consistently play the same size rooms. So I think that gives the impression that they're probably a little bit bigger.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's to their credit, really. I mean,
definitely.
You know, I mean, during the kind of fallow years, you know, like in the early aughts, they really like they kept it going.
Yeah, they were still out there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Those guys really. I mean, I've got nothing but, you know, good things to say about Real Big Fish. I think they deserve all the credit in the world.
The swing thing. I don't know. This is such a broad question, so I apologize. But do you know why it happened and why it got so big? Because it's still kind of boggles my mind a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. And I lived through that time and I still don't quite get it.
Yeah, no, it had like been this kind of popular like underground thing in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And, you know, I think as soon as anything kind of gains enough steam on the underground, the, you know, labels come and kind of start sniffing it out. And, you know, it had a look. It was like something you could sort of package and be like, hey, this is like a new thing. And I don't know, beyond that, you know, I think it's sort of like one of the kind of like underlying theories of my book is I just think that it was sort of like the right music for the right time in the like late 90s, you know, sort of ska in a similar way where just like some of the bad things that had been happening in like the earlier part of the decade had, you know, kind of been forgotten a little bit. And like the economy was doing really well and there weren't a lot of conflicts with like other countries or anything. And I don't know, I just feel like, you know, swing and ska were sort of, I mean, like in the same way that, you know, grunge was like the right music and gangster rap was like the right music for like 90, you know, two, I think ska and swing was right for like, you know, for like 5 or 6 years later.
Mm-hmm. Lighthearted music for light times.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, there were like obviously ska bands that were, you know, singing about serious things, but I think by and large, I'm just kind of like thinking back to the shows that I went to, like in high school, certainly, you know, there was a certain, you know, political consciousness to it, but I think for a lot of people, it was just about like, these are super fun shows. You can go and you can dance. And it was unlike anything that I had ever experienced up to that point, you know?
Tell us your personal reference point. When you got into this music, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think I discovered ska music on my last day of middle school. We were going on like a field trip or something, and like there was like a few friends of mine were like, "Hey man, you got to hear this new thing that we just found out about." And they had like a stack of records, and or actually they would have been, and somebody's a Discman probably, so it was a bunch of compact discs as it were. But yeah, I remember they, you know, somebody had a Voodoo Glow Skulls, Who Is This Is. They had this compilation that was called Skanarchy, which actually came out around the same time as Misfits of Ska. It was like in 95, I want to say, and it was, you know, sort of like ska punk leaning. So it was sort of, it had like, you know, Meth Ska Felice was on it. It had MU330, Digits was on there. That, you know, really weird song, Digits.
Great song.
It is a great song. That was my first exposure to that band. And I was like, wow, there are a bunch of foot fetishes. Okay, that's cool. That's cool. You know, it had Springheel Jack, who was like the big local band in Connecticut, where I'm from. I think somebody had like Operation Ivy too that day. So I just, you know, got played all this stuff on like a school bus, I don't know, going to the beach or something, and was just like, wow, this is incredible. And I spent the whole, you know, 2 months kind of leading up to my freshman year of high school, just like learning as much as I could about it. And I would go to like the local, like, you know, Borders Books and Music. And I remember I got, Bim Scala Bim Live at the Paradise, and I got Toasters, and then probably like Ska Boom, just, you know, picked up as much stuff as I could, tried to learn as much as I could. It actually turned out that a friend of my dad's from like back when he was a kid, this guy, Larry Parisino, he had been like really into two-tone, like you know, back in the day, like at the actual time it was happening. So like as soon as he heard that I was into ska, he gave me the Specials, the singles collection, and that just, you know, blew the doors off it for me. And then from there I was just like obsessed with two-tone pretty much going forward. And yeah, spent all of my high school years just, you know, seeing local bands, seeing national bands, just trying to learn about, you know, kind of trying to learn about as much about it as I could.
So high school for you was 96, 97, 98, 99 then?
Yeah, I graduated in 99. So I guess we started.
Wow, so you're like right in it then, like all through high school.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it was fall of 95 I started. I remember going to my first ska show. It was just I'm a couple days before school started that year. So this would have been like August, 95, I guess. And I remember my friend had a copy of Rancid's Outcome of the Wolves that had like just come out, and it was like playing that on the way to my first ska show. And so it was sort of, I mean, that was like before, like, you know, Time Bomb even, you know, blew up on radio. So it was kind of, I don't know, it was kind of like perfect sign of the Times record to be hearing on the way to my first ska show. But
what show was that you were headed to?
It was a Springheel Jack was the headliner with Johnny Too Bad and the Strikeouts, who were this sort of great mod ska band out of Connecticut. I actually wrote about both of those bands on my newsletter that I started, because I wasn't able to fit them into the book, but I wanted to, you know, pay homage to both of those bands, because they were definitely you know, formative bands for me, for sure.
Johnny Too Bad and the Strikeouts had Mara Breen of Siren Six later. Really cool connection there.
Yeah, that was her band before the Siren Six. I think she joined after Johnny Too Bad sort of split up. But yeah, they were fantastic. They had like the whole mod, you know, look down, and they put out a record on Moon in I guess like 97, I guess it was. They were just a fantastic band.
Your book focuses not exclusively, but primarily on the bigger bands, the bands that were more recognizable in the mainstream culture, whereas your newsletter focuses on lesser known bands. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the decision on both of those parts.
Yeah, so, you know, with the book, I was I'm trying to look at, you know, ska and swing as sort of mainstream phenomenons, and sort of why they both got really popular when they did. this is kind of going back to my kind of underlying thesis about, you know, the late 90s and the sort of general cultural mood, I guess, at the time. So I guess I just wanted to kind of talk about bands that almost any kid that had gone to high school in like the late 90s, like might have heard of, you know. So I didn't want to get too obscure, but I also wanted to, you know, paint a pretty, you know, broad picture of what like both of the scenes were like. So, you know, I've got like Hep Cat and the Slackers and the Pie Tasters, who are, you know, maybe bands that you wouldn't necessarily know about if you were just, you know, listening to alt rock radio. Although, you know, to some extent, all those bands had some kind of MTV exposure. But yeah, I just kind of wanted it to be like, for like, you know, people of that generation, they could like see this like book in a store and be like, oh yeah, like I know all these bands, and I never thought to like associate them together, like the Boss Tones and Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. Like, you know, why would like they be the same? But you know, maybe they like have certain things in common, and maybe they, you know, it's not an accident maybe why they both got, you know, super big around the same time.
And so you wanted to highlight the lesser known, like these sort of obscure bands for your newsletter, to sort of pay homage to these, the bands that were kind of operating underneath the mainstream level of ska.
Yeah. Just cause I was like a huge fan of these bands, and you know, I mean, if the book could have been longer, I would have had Thumper in there, and I would have had Spring Heel Jack, and you know, all the ones that I've done for my newsletter. But yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, I was kind of trying to, you know, look at it like more as like a mainstream phenomenon. But yeah, like this music was, you know, super important to me growing up. And yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want people to think that I like only knew the big mainstream bands, because I had, I had like every ska compilation that like you could ever think of. And I mean, I was fairly well versed in it, I like to think anyway.
We've brought up Thumper several times on this podcast.
Yeah. Wasn't it Patrick Stump? Right?
Patrick Stump knew them, and that blew Adam's mind, because that's Adam's favorite track, I believe, right? From Misfits of Ska 2?
Absence was the band that I really liked that Patrick brought up.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, Thumper's come up a couple times on the podcast, and I was lucky enough on tour to see them play a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
Really great.
Yeah, so good.
Like, I feel like your description of them in your newsletter, I think you said, you know, in addition to ska, hardcore, you had a couple other musical landmarks for them. And I was like right on board with that. And
yeah.
then just, I remember we had their album, at least one of their albums, in our van.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it had like this really religious looking cover.
Yeah. Yeah, that was probably their, Hellfire and Damnation, that album. Yeah, that's a great album.
What was your introduction to Thumper? Was it from Misfits of Ska 2, or did you see them, you know, just as a band playing?
So, yeah, Thumper was on that Skanarchy compilation that I mentioned.
Oh, okay.
It was one of the first things I ever heard. But also, you know, they were from outside of Boston, so they were somewhat local to me. You know, I'm from New England, so they would come around to, you know, and come through Connecticut a lot. And yeah, I think a friend of mine, you know, made me a tape of their album, No One Left the Disco Alive, which has got some really great songs on it. And, you know, they were like, you know, talking about like religion, and, you know, they were like a fairly, you know, political and, you know, topical band, but just like always couched in, you know, a lot of humor and just like really smart lyrics. And then also just like these, you know, super heavy guitars that were just insane too. they were just such a weird band. It was a real thrill to actually, you know, talk to them for this newsletter.
What was their shows like? I never got to see that band live.
I saw them only one time, and it was like the weirdest show that I've ever been to. It was them and Mephistopheles and Gwar was the headliner.
Oh, nice.
That sounds like a great show.
It was a really great show. So it's, yeah, it was like a mix of, you know, skinheads and like ska kids, and then just, you know, metalheads that were there to see Gwar. And yeah, Thumper was great that night. I think they actually won over the room pretty well. Just, you know, their stuff was, you know, pretty heavy, like I said. So I think if any ska band like was going to go down at a Gwar show, it was going to be Thumper, you know.
You've kind of stated this already a few times, what your thesis of your book is. But I'm curious, because my book, I had a point that I was making, and that the reason I wanted to write it, that was to maybe expose people to what I felt like was the reality of ska and the ska scene beyond what their stereotypes were about it.
Mm-hmm.
what was kind of driving you to write a book about ska, and what did you feel like was the purpose behind it?
I was just trying to make a lot of money, really. There's just like so much money in it. No.
So much money in it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, not at all. I mean, if you actually broke it down by hour, the hourly rate for writing this book would be, oh my God, I don't even want to think about it that way.
Let's not go there.
Yeah, no, the real reason is, I think it was kind of like you, Aaron, where I love this music a lot, and I read a lot of rock books. I've been, you know, doing music journalism for a long time, and I felt like there wasn't really a book about this era. You know, there were some books about ska that were like pretty good, and they covered all the waves and stuff, but there was like really nowhere that you could go to read about these bands that are like in my book, really, you know, at the time.
Yeah.
And I also just had this idea too about, you know, about like bringing the swing thing into it too, and just really, you know, sort of writing more about this era and this time in like American pop culture. And yeah, that to me seemed like it, you know, it was this kind of like unexplored, you know, area. And also too, like we said, you know, swing was pretty, you know, crapped upon by most people, and so was ska. So it you know, kind of seemed like an opportunity to be like, well, hey, everybody, like, you know, maybe you have the wrong idea about this thing that was actually like a lot cooler than you think. And there was, you know, more variety than you think. And there were some really creative bands.
How did you land on that title?
I had that pretty early on. I was trying to find I knew that I wanted it to be a song title, and I wanted it like to be something that would like cover both ska and swing. So I was, you know, there's like, you know, Pinstripe Suit, I think Let's Go Bowling, I think has a song called Pinstripe Suit or something. And so that was a possibility, but I'm a big Boss Tones fan, and that song Hell of a Hat off of Question the Answers, which I think is their best album. I'd always loved that song, and you know, there were sort of hats were, you know, somewhat common, I guess you could say, in both the ska and the swing scene. I know it's also one of the things that people probably, you know, tease both of the genres about, and like, you know, a bunch of dudes wearing fedoras or whatever, but you know, it's actually pork pies and ska, so it was different, or, you know, the golf hats or whatever. But like, I don't know, it just seemed like a really good, it's a song that I like a lot. And, you know, the Boss Tones are the first, yeah, chapter in the book, and it can kind of apply to both of the scenes. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Your thesis, was that early on that you sort of decided that was the angle that the book was going to take? Or did you land on that after working through the idea a bit?
Yeah, no, that was there pretty much right from the start. That was kind of the whole idea for doing it, because I really couldn't think of, I mean, I think that if I had done a book that was sort of just about third wave ska, then I would have covered more of these bands like, you know, Thumper and Spring Heel Jack that I have in my newsletter. I guess I was trying to find a sort of angle that was a little bit more sort of widescreen and would maybe like appeal to a larger audience of just, you know, people my age who have some kind of fondness for like either of these genres. And, you know, I think it is like a different way to look at those years maybe. And I know that's what it was for me, like just in sort of thinking about it and kind of formulating it. It was just kind of like a way to kind of reassess my teen years in a way, you know, like I think there was, you know, I think there are some people who are the sort of more two-tone purists who are like, you know, it's kind of a shame that American ska was not, you know, two-tone basically. Right. And
yeah.
And I guess the, you know, thing that I'm trying to say in this book is, well, it was a totally different, you know, time and place. You know what I mean? Like there was no way that the ska that came out of like Orange County in the mid 90s was going to be as, you know, fiercely political as the stuff that came out of Coventry in, you know, 79. It was just, it's like apples and oranges, you know, but that doesn't mean that it should be dismissed. Right.
Yeah, and I get some of the times I would be reading and getting the impression that you were almost like, I don't know if I would use the word conflicted, but almost like you were trying to be like, well, you know, there's good and bad about this era. And here's my thoughts to summarize both sides of that.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand some of the arguments and, you know, maybe some of the reasons that you know, people are not as fond of the American third wave stuff or the stuff that got popular. But I think ultimately what I tried to do with pretty much every band that I profile in the book, I think I ultimately take a pretty positive view of what they did. You know, I'm trying to think if there's anyone that I really, I mean, I think all these bands are, you know, worthwhile in their own way.
Yeah, I think like, and I, what you did, I appreciate, because I think a point that I was trying to make in my book that I don't know that I was even aware of until after is that not so much defending them, like being like, they're all great, they're all awesome. I think it was more just like, why can't we talk about ska bands in a way that's like the way we talk about other genres, where other genres, it's like that you have a critical analysis of the bands, not just,
yeah, exactly.
Not just like, oh, this was a dumb time period and this music was silly, or it's a guilty pleasure, or it's just fun and I like it, but actually have a serious critical discussion of the bands and the time period and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Now that's something that I think definitely comes across in, I mean, your book. And yeah, that's what I was trying to do too, is like, you know, these are records that are not going to be, you know, Pitchfork, like, you know, Sunday reviews in most cases, like maybe, you know, Tragic Kingdom or something. But I wanted to, you know, spend a couple of paragraphs talking about, you know, Big Daddy Multitude by like Mustard Plug, and like, you know, digging into some of the songs. And because I don't know if like anyone else really like was, you know, doing that prior. And, you know, that was a record just to like pick one at random that, you know, meant a lot to me and my friends, my like freshman year of high school. And I feel like there was like nothing written about it anywhere. So let's, you know, talk about it a little bit.
For sure. I know. And yeah, I know it's weird because like I did a thing on Crab Rangoon, and then I've since done like two podcasts about it. And it's very surreal to me because I never really would imagine this much discussion would take place around this one album. and I'm sure the band are very, very, it's very surreal to them too, that all this discussion has happened around this one album. So, but you know, it's, I feel like it's warranted, and like there, you know, people have responded to this discussion of Crab Rangoon.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, I love this album, and they want to just, they want to dig into it and talk about the music and the lyrics and it's time. It's like, it's context and everything. It's just like,
yeah,
I feel like there's so many people hungry for ska to be talked about in a serious capacity.
I agree. And I think that was there for a long time, you know, and I think that's why, you know, your book is, you know, done as well as it has, because there's been a huge audience for this. And yeah, like, I think you're, you know, looking at these records with a lot of respect. I mean, just to even talk about them and, you know, kind of like go deep on them and, you know, break down the songs, that just kind of like implies a, you know, level of respect for the artist that, you know, for all these years, you know, different genres have always gotten that kind of respect. But, you know, ska never, like, there's been no real, you know, critical, I mean, you know, like with the two-tone stuff, like that stuff's always been, you know, pretty respected. And I think the Jamaican stuff too, but yeah, like any kind of American ska just kind of gets like written off immediately by the, you know, tastemakers.
Even the two-tone bands, I think you can get the tastemakers to concede on them, but they're not going to talk about Specials the way they talk about Joy Division. They're,
yeah,
it's,
that's true.
Not the same thing. I mean, they'll be like, yeah, okay, that's cool and everything, but, you know, then let me, yeah, let me talk about The Fall for 2 years.
Yeah, well, that's how long it takes to talk about The Fall, though, because they had, you know, 97,000 albums.
So. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, so your book, I feel like, is great because you really dig, you dig into this one specific time period in a very, very critical way. You know, like, you can tell that you're a longtime music journalist and you're sort of approaching it that way. And then Mark's book, I like a lot because he just went the oral history route and he took this whole era that's like completely forgotten and completely missing from the discussion. Like, there's so many books about 80s alternative music, mm-hmm, no mentions of ska ever.
Yeah, yeah, never, never.
And it's ridiculous because all of those brilliant bands that we all hail as like legends, they all played with ska bands.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah, so for sure. Like,
yeah, yeah. No, Mark's book is fantastic too. Yeah, I mean, you know, for all the reasons that that you said, and it's this, you know, massive, you know, time period that people don't know that much about. And it's like, if you want to know anything about it, you know, Mark's book will just tell you everything about it. You
sure,
know, it's,
yeah, like
everything. So it's, yeah, it's, I think it's cool that all three of our books, I mean, it could have been like a real disaster if they'd all come out in the same year and like pretty much covered the same stuff. But it's cool that we all kind of came at it from a different angle and have different stuff to say about it.
We could have been sworn enemies if we were all like writing the same book, but now we get to be, yeah, friends.
Yeah, no, it's good.
I think the best part is that, you know, Aaron's out here on the West Coast and both you and Mark were back on the East Coast, so you both have slightly different perspectives on it.
Right.
I mean, the national bands end up being the same, but then the smaller underground stuff, or even just the stuff that was happening in each scene, you know, because it's such a pain to drive all the way across the country.
Yeah.
And even if you do, you know, if you don't catch that band when they come through.
Yeah. No, that's a good point.
Never get to see them.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's walk, since your book focuses on the sort of the cultural phenomenon of ska, let's walk through ska as a mainstream sort of entity. So
yeah.
In your view, when does ska crack mainstream culture?
Well, it's interesting. There had been a lot of articles in like the mid 90s. There was a Billboard article that I think both of us mentioned in our books, and then a New York Times article that was like just after Time Bomb hit, I think is when the Times article.
So yeah, like, exactly. Yeah.
Late 95, maybe, I guess that was. It was definitely bubbling up at that point, and, you know, Time Bomb being a big hit. But I think a lot of people that heard Time Bomb probably wouldn't have even probably didn't know enough to call it ska. Even like if you were just like some kid listening to alt rock radio and you were used to, you know, Dishwalla or something, and then like Time Bomb came on, I don't know if you were like, oh yeah, that's a ska song, you know. I think it took a little bit. I think, you know, No Doubt kind of hitting, and then people started talking about ska even though the songs weren't like really ska songs, and you know, Sublime, and I don't know. I mean, I like the moment where it like really cracked through. I mean, yeah, maybe the Boss Tones with the Impression That I Get, because that went to number one on the alternative charts, which is that's a pretty big deal, I think. And like that song was everywhere that summer. And that was the same summer as, you know, the MTV Scatterday, which I think is something, I mean, it'd be fun to talk about, because I think we have somewhat different opinions maybe on the MTV Scatterday thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
I might be the only defender in the whole entire world of MTV Scatterday.
Wow, you're about to be in defense of Scatterday?
Yeah.
This is probably more has to do with our age and when we started in the ska scene. But yes, please make your case. Defend Scatterday.
Wow, this is even harder than trying to defend swing, I think. I don't
know. Well, let's take a step back.
Okay, all right.
Just to explain what Scatterday is first, just in case there's somebody listening who doesn't know what that is.
So this was, I think it was June 28th, 1997. For some reason, MTV took two whole hours and played nothing but ska videos with a then unknown VJ named Carson Daly, wearing a black suit and a black hat and black sunglasses, and with like a whole bunch of kids behind him, you know, kind of skanking around. And it was like a weird assortment of, I think, like ska kids, and then also just kids that were hanging out at like the MTV Motel California. So there was,
yeah,
you know, varying levels of skanking. But yeah, it was 2 hours of ska when you would have never expected it, basically. This was when like MTV was still a really big deal in terms of, you know, like people watched it to like hear music and see music videos. And I had no idea that it was going to be on. I just happened to be home that day. Well, I was home a lot in those days, but I was just flipping through the channels, and this was like the height of my ska obsession. And I was like, holy shit, what is this? And I popped a VHS tape in that I'm actually now looking at, cause I've got it here in the room with me. I dug it out recently, but it's, yeah, Carson playing ska videos and, you know, trying and, you know, failing in a lot of cases to kind of fill people in on ska's history in between videos.
So, okay. You have a positive view of Scatterday. Let's hear it.
I do. Yeah. It was, you know, very rare to see ska videos in those days. And it was, you know, they showed the Boss Tones, and they showed No Doubt, and they showed Real Big Fish, and all the bands you would think, but they also showed, you know, Fishbone, Party at Ground Zero. They showed The Specials. They showed Madness. They showed The Untouchables, even though it wasn't a ska song. They showed, you know, Tin Spam by the Stubborn All-Stars. And, you know, to see this stuff on TV, these were all records that I loved. And, you know, I'd never seen a Madness video before. Well, I mean, you know, I'd seen like Our House, because that is played on VH1 and stuff, but I'd never seen One Step Beyond. I'd never seen, you know, Message to You, Rudy, the video for that by the Specials. So to actually, you know, like get to see this stuff, it was incredible. And I think too, like, you know, like I was never the kind of person that was like super protective of stuff that I liked. Like, it's like just for the real heads. Like, you know, like I thought Sky was great, and I was all for more people learning about it. And I mean, even though Carson was like no PhD in ska, and he certainly, you know, sort of like, you know, fumbled through a lot of those interludes, I think ultimately, if that turns some kids onto like Stubborn All-Stars or something, then man, that's a great thing.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I will definitely agree that the song selection was good. I mean, all the songs you mentioned, I think there was like Two-Tone Army by Toasters, which had
Toasters were on there, yeah.
Which had a pretty low budget video because it wasn't made for MTV.
Yeah. That was actually a shot by our friend Steve Schaefer shot that video.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, definitely props to their selection. Although, to be fair, I think their selection was pretty much every ska video that existed at the time, because there really wasn't a lot to choose from. So they, I think, maybe were forced to put good stuff in there.
That's true. But they could have just made it like a half hour show and just played, you know, Goldfinger and the Boss Tones. Or, you know what I mean?
I guess, like, you know, I came down on it in my book only because I felt like it was just a good example of how the music was getting sold to the public in a way that would eventually lead to it being viewed as a trend that would be an embarrassing trend for people that had been a part of it, rather than really kind of giving people a good understanding of what ska was and was about. So I only talked about it negatively because of that, although I did state that the music was good, and I do stand by that. And
yeah, that's a fair point, I think. I mean, you know.
I'm not against, I guess I have, I'm really split at this idea of like how I feel about, I'm not precious about ska being like put in the mainstream at all. And I've had definitely talked to people who are like 5 to 6 years younger than me who learned about ska from MTV and then became big fans and then also learned a lot about ska from that. And that's awesome. I think it's more, I guess you have to criticize the way the mainstream tended to, you know, just not understand the things that they're hyping up, and then what the effects of that, the longevity of that thing is. That's the element, I think.
No, that's a fair point. I mean, I guess I just think out of all the examples of that, you know, I think, you know, Scatterday wasn't like necessarily the worst offender in that. I mean, it was only on once on this one
sure,
day.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people actually saw it, because I've told people about it over the years, and they're like, "That didn't happen." I'm like, no, it did.
It definitely did.
It really did, you know. But it was like, I mean, like if anybody watched the whole thing, they, you know, they saw some pretty incredible videos, and they would have come away with, I think, like a better understanding of ska as like not just being, you know, Real Big Fish or something. Like, not that there's anything wrong with them, but I think it actually painted a pretty broad picture of what ska could be.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think I need to go. I think I need to go edit my book now.
No. I mean, look, let's face it. The Carson, you know, some of the interludes are pretty, they're pretty cringe. And yeah, I mean, I'm not going to defend all of MTV Scatterday. I just think, yeah, like, on the balance, I think it was more a positive maybe than it was a negative.
Sure.
I don't know. It's fun to look at it now and just, you know, laugh about it a little bit too. So
I agree with you though. Actually, there were way worse examples of that. Like I've seen, not at the time, I can't remember, but it, you know, in like on YouTube, I've seen things where it's like little news clips about ska, and it's like,
oh, I love those. Yeah,
they're like 5 minutes long, and then they lump in the weirdest bands. They're like 311, Sugar Ray, you know.
Yeah,
they just take these bands and you're like, whoa, you guys are pretty far off from, you know, it's a bit of a stretch to be throwing in No Doubt, and you know, Sublime is kind of a interesting, you know, there's a case for and against Sublime, but Sugar Ray, 311, I mean,
yeah, no, there's absolutely no case to be made. Yeah, there was a funny one that I saw recently that somebody posted on Twitter where it was like, I don't know if it was from like the E Network or something, and it was like this like new trend of ska, and they showed Squirrel Nut Zippers as part of it. And it was just like, so like if you have a trumpet now, you're just ska,
yeah.
Full stop. It's like, you know, Cake is like now a ska band, I guess.
Your book deals a lot with the conditions and the people and the situations that sort of set up the ska explosion. Kind of talk a little bit about Boss Tones' like long journey to becoming pop stars.
Yeah, they had like the longest journey. I mean, they, you know, got together all the way back in like the early 80s, you know, like 83, 84, I think it was. Yeah, I guess 84, I think. And, you know, they were together for, like a few years, and then they actually broke up, you know, and they were like broken up for a while. And when I talked to Joe Gittleman for the book, he said that, you know, there was, you know, like there was kind of no thought that the band was like going to get back together at any point. Like they had just kind of done their thing. They'd played a bunch of local shows to a bunch of their friends and did like one show with Fishbone. That was sort of like their big thing that they did. But, you know, they all kind of went their separate ways. And then by 89, they just kind of met back up and like, all right, we'll give it another go. And, you know, caught on and kind of like, you know, built this huge fan base. It was, you know, really the reason why they had majors coming to look at them is because they would play these, you know, shows up and down New England where it would be kids all dressed in plaid, you know, lined up around the block. And, you know, they just had like kind of built this whole thing themselves. And, you know, Joe was saying that, you know, the guy who signed them to Mercury, like it wasn't because he thought ska was going to be the next big thing. He was just like, there's a bunch of kids who are coming to see you who are like dressing just like you. He's like, I don't know what this is, but I'm going to sign it up. And then, you know, signed like Ugly Kid Joe was like the next band that he signed after that. So like, you know, he, you know, wasn't thinking about ska as being a mainstream thing, but yeah, they kind of took the ultimate long road to the top.
And even like, even the Tang signing them. And when they reformed was like, they weren't even really much of a buzz band or anything at that point. Tang just kind of took a risk on them or just liked them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There was a thing in their contract that said they had to play 20 shows per year to, you know, promote whatever came out on Tang, which is a funny, I mean, if you think about the Boston's being like this, like band that's been, you know, most of that decade on the road, you know, they were like the ultimate road dogs. And
yeah,
you know, to think that like, you know, the label's like, well, you got to play 20 shows. It's like, okay, well, yeah, we'll cover that. But
the Boston's were really interesting too, because in that era, they really got super serious about it, so much that they would be on the road all the time, like you're saying. But when they were home, they would rehearse like all the time while they were not touring, even though they were touring so much. They were like,
yeah,
God, they were pretty crazy actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it shows. I mean, they're a, you know, super tight band, even, you know, to this day with all their lineup changes. But yeah, that's something that I think even like at the time, like, you know, 25 years ago, I didn't realize how tight that band was and like how good the rhythm section was. And yeah, they definitely brought the goods.
When I saw Boston's in like 95, actually, I was a little surprised at how big they were. I knew they were a major label band, but they didn't have like singles. And I was like a little surprised at like the size rooms they were playing. And mm-hmm. I was also like, they were really struck me as like highly professional. Like most of the bands that I was a big fan of that I loved, you know, like Skank and Pickle was high on that list. Even like bands like Fishbone, it was like chaos first. Musicianship second, and musicianship was there, don't get me wrong, but chaos was the priority. Boston's, it was like you can tell the way that they like position themselves, the way that like certain members really didn't like focus on performing, that they were just there to like lay down the groundwork, and then kind of certain members were there to be like showmen. It was like a different kind of experience.
No, that's true. I think I saw them that same year. Was the first time I saw them. And yeah, that's why they've got, you know, that's why they have Ben Carr dancing around on stage, so the others can just focus on. But yeah, I think there's a reason why. I mean, you know, people, I don't know, like all the mainstream bands get sort of slagged off, but I think there's a reason why the Boston's made it for sure.
So in between Question the Answers and Let's Face It, you were writing about how they were watching ska become sort of a thing, and they were having conversations with their label about, you know, the potential for writing songs that maybe were less antagonistic and were more pop oriented. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there was a conversation that Dickie Barrett was telling me about that he had with Danny Goldberg, who had just been brought in as the head of Mercury. I think he had been Nirvana's manager, you know, back in the days, a pretty, you know, big time guy in the music world. And he was like, you know, I sort of get what you guys are doing. You like have these songs that are these kind of like anti songs, he called them, you know, they're like, they're not quite right for radio. And he's like, you know, I totally get that. And I like what you guys are doing. And that's cool. You can like totally keep on doing that. And like, we're on board with it. But, you know, there's like another way to do this where you can actually have some songs that like reach a lot of people and actually say something, and you don't have to compromise, you know, whatever part of yourselves you guys are like scared of compromising. And I think they kind of took that to heart going into, you know, the next record. And yeah, I think too, like, you know, Joe Gittleman said that when he heard Outcome the Wolves, he like went to like a mall and actually bought it and like played it in his car all the way through before he even left the parking lot. And like, he could just tell that the, you know, temperature was kind of changing on like alternative radio, and whereas it had been so like grunge heavy just a few years earlier, you know, now that a song like Time Bomb could get played, there was, you know, maybe more opportunity for the Boss Tones.
So you guys talked about the impression I get. It's weird. That song has kind of come up recently in pop culture, and people have discussed or hypothesized what the meaning is. And I've seen all kinds of weird theories about that. The one that I think is the most interesting is that it's about AIDS.
Yeah.
But you talked to Dickie. So tell us a little bit about what the song's about and where it came from.
Well, so the idea for the song came, he was at a close friend of his friend's brother had died, you know, fairly young, and he was at a funeral. He was, you know, seeing all these people that were, you know, grieving, and he was on the front porch of this house that he had like gone to when he was a kid. And he sort of realized that he had never been through anything that was that trying before, you know, like he'd never been through something like this. And he was kind of thinking about like how he would deal with it basically, or like, you know, what, like, you know, could he like deal with it? And so that was kind of the starting point for it. I think he wrote down like some words actually at the funeral in like a notepad or something. That's kind of what the first verse is about. And then, you know, by the second verse, it's sort of a broader thing where he's kind of talking about, you know, kids growing up in this generation, and they've never had like a, you know, World War II or like a Vietnam. They've, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of a song about like, you know, what would happen if you ever had to face something like this, you know, could you rise to the challenge? And in the chorus, he's saying, you know, I've never had to, you know, knock on wood that I've never had to, but, you know, cause I've heard it isn't good. And, you know, so it's, you know, the song, I think actually, in some ways kind of speaks to my like underlying thesis of the book. And it's just kind of about this like 90s generation that has never been tested. You know what I mean? Like in some ways. And, I'm not sure if people, when they heard the song, when it came out, if that message kind of resonated, but I know, I think it's sort of interesting that like that's kind of the underlying idea of the song.
So after you got out of high school, like 2000, 2001,
mm-hmm.
And ska had kind of gained a bad reputation at this point, where were you on all of this? Where was your listening habits, and what were you gravitating towards?
Well, I went to school up in Boston, and I still went to a lot of ska shows. You know, the Boston ska scene was, you know, pretty great back in those days. And I'd go see like, you know, the Slackers when they came through, and all the national bands. I think I did start to branch out a little bit in my listening habits. I don't know if it was like so much because ska wasn't cool anymore, but like more that I feel like ska kind of like awakened in me this like passion for music that like ultimately kind of led me to, you know, a bunch of other things. You know, it was like from the Specials, you know, I was like, you know, reading a bunch about them. And then I got super into the Clash when I was in high school. And from the Clash, I got really into like rockabilly and like, you know, dub reggae and all kinds of things that like the Clash played. So that, you know, led me in like a million directions. And, you know, eventually I went through like a, you know, Depeche Mode and, you know, Smith's phase, because everyone does. Or I don't know if everyone does, but I certainly did.
Mine was in high school when I went through that phase. And I actually funny story. And I've never, ever, ever dressed ska. But I did kind of dress appropriate for a very brief time to that music, where I was really into these like slightly baggy black pants and these white button up shirts. It's unusual, because I have zero interest in fashion in my entire life.
It's a good look though. You know, it's a sort of standard. It can be a ska look.
Sure.
It's like a casual Friday ska look.
What did you think of that period there for a while where bands were trying to hide their ska origins?
Yeah, that I didn't much care for. I can't think of any records that sort of came out of that period by any of those bands that I really like all that much. Yeah. Trying to act like you were never ska is, you know, not a good look, I don't think.
It doesn't work because it's like insulting to the ska fans, and then the non-ska fans that you're trying to win over, they aren't interested.
Exactly.
because you sound too much like ska already.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it's like in your book, like when you talk about Slow Gherkin, which was a band that I love that band in high school. I got the there's this compilation, This Is Raj, This Is Ska. You probably know it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, that also turned me on to, you know, Filibuster. I love that band. And Punch the Clown, I think they're on there. Anyway, but yeah, Slow Gherkin, and I ended up, you know, buying the Double Happiness, right? That was the album that came out.
Yeah, their first album. Yeah,
you know, played the hell out of that for like, you know, 6 months straight. And yeah, they even like admit it in your book, basically, that it was a bad look to all of a sudden be like, we're not ska anymore. Right. I mean, that was the whole gist of it, basically, right? Is they were like, you know, like with hindsight, they kind of feel like they, you know, maybe, but I understand a temptation, because, you know, it was like, this was not a time where you could really sort of go around advertising your ska fandom necessarily.
Yeah. I think James said that it was a chicken shit move.
Yep.
Yeah.
What do you think is greater, ska shame or swing shame?
Swing
shame is way bigger.
I'm not sure if there is any swing shame, though, because I mean, swing, like, nobody even like really talks about it as much. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like if you were a swing fan,
I think that's why there's so much shame. People don't even want to talk about it.
Maybe the shame is so deep. that's a good question. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I guess probably the swing shame for people, but, and hopefully my book will, you know, you can
help alleviate some of their swing shame.
Hold your head up high and admit that you were into this music. It's okay.
Dig way deep into the back of your closet and find that Zeus suit and that long chain that you used to wear. Use those swing dance lessons that you took.
It's like riding a bike. You never forget how to Lindy hop, I don't think.
So when did you become a music journalist?
It was in my last semester of college. I was in an economics major, actually. And for some reason I was out one day with a friend, and my friend like knew somebody that was the arts editor at the school paper. And my friend was like, oh, like, you know, my roommate, you know, loves music. Like, you know, you should like have him write something for you. And she's like, yeah, if you want to write something. So I went to the meeting and, you know, started doing like record reviews or something. And I was like, whoa, you can get people to send you free records. This is incredible. And you can like interview people on the phone. And so, yeah, once I graduated, I started freelancing for different places, and have done it in, you know, one capacity or another for the last almost 20 years.
My becoming a music journalist in 2009 was a huge step towards me writing this book, just because being a music journalist and a ska fan seemed to be almost like these like opposite things in our culture. And that was like part of what, like, you know, I thought about a lot. How did having been a music journalist for pretty much your entire adult life impact your desire to write about ska?
Well, I sort of tried to sneak it in a lot over the years. I kind of started out doing a lot of concert reviews for the paper in Hartford, the Hartford Current, which is like the big paper in Connecticut. And I would review, you know, Mustard Plug or the Slackers or like whoever was, you know, coming to town. And yeah, like over the years, I think I've always tried to sneak in some ska content here or there whenever you can get, you know, some editors to kind of take a chance on stuff. I mean, you know, for a long time there, it was a hard sell, as I'm sure you know, Aaron. It was, you know, it's not easy to get people. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, there are like that, you know, Playboy piece that you did, like that, like that's a great example of, you know, somebody taking a chance on it and a great story blossoming out, you know, out of it. So that's cool.
Yeah. Do you know who took a big chance on that article?
Who?
His name was James Rickman from Slow Gherkin.
Oh, that's right. The editor. Yeah. Yeah, you told me that. Yeah, that's right. You told me that, I think, in your DMs one day on Twitter. You told me that. That's right.
I mean, but that's kind of the cool thing, though, is that the people who kind of are in power now in those positions of being editors were once 14-year-old ska kids.
That's the thing. Like, yeah, I mean, I think almost any white male age, I don't know, like 35 to 45, has probably some like secret ska past, right?
Definitely.
To some extent.
I want to ask you about one specific ska article you wrote. And I read this when it came out. You got an article in Pitchfork about ska.
I did, yeah.
Wow. And now, so I'd like to take a moment. People made a big deal about Jeff Rosenstock getting Pitchfork to say that ska is cool this year. Mm-hmm. But you got Pitchfork to But you write an article about Scott in 2015.
That's true, yeah.
So, yeah. Please tell us about this.
I would say this was sort of like the start of me thinking kind of more critically about ska and about like 90s ska and its kind of place in the whole story. I'm not sure that I necessarily kind of stand by everything in that piece, but yeah, the piece was kind of written about because I noticed there were some things happening with some of the like two-tone bands. There was like a new...
Yeah.
It was a new like English Beat record was in the works. There was a new Selector album that was, I think it had like just come out. So it was sort of, you know, the article is sort of about, you know, people hate ska, but, you know, let's like forget about the American stuff for a second. You know, two-tone was this sort of great, you know, it was this like anti-racist music and it had this, you know, great social consciousness to it. Yeah, I guess I was just trying to kind of draw more attention to two-tone and just how, because like that's music that I think has, like as I've gotten into like other things and even during my, you know, Depeche Mode Smiths period, like I was always listening to like more specials, you know, or like Madness, like that stuff was always with me. And I just wanted to, I guess, kind of give props to that. I mean, it wasn't really like an attempt to, you know, diss 90s ska at all. It was more just sort of like, let's, you know, celebrate two-tone for what it was.
So tell me a little bit about, did you intend that article? Was Pitchfork your first pick on who to submit that to?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I think at that point I had written a couple other things for Pitchfork. I had like finally broken in there. It was actually Jessica Hopper was the editor of that section at the time. It was called, called The Pitch, which it still exists. Like they do these sort of,
it's more like
think
pieces.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'd written something about Latin freestyle music, which I always loved. You know, stuff like, you know, Lisa and that kind of stuff in the 80s. I think I was just, you know, trying to think of something else that I, you know, knew a lot about and I sort of cared a lot about. And yeah, you know, ska came to mind and I was like, yeah, what the hell, I'll just kind of give it a shot. And I mean, I'd have to go back and look at it because I actually can't really like recall exactly what I said, but I know that it, like, you know, the whole gist of it basically was that, you know, the American bands were not as political as the two-tone bands. I think it was the beginning of sort of me thinking about 90s ska kind of more critically. And it kind of ultimately led me to this idea of, well, yeah, like 90s ska wasn't a two-tone, but that's because like America in the late 90s was not, you know, Coventry 1979 or London 1979. It was a totally different, you know, place and totally different set of circumstances. And to try to expect the ska from the 90s to be the same as a two-tone, I think is, you know, sort of foolhardy.
Was the editor interested right off the bat or did she take some convincing? I'm curious about this because they have close to zero ska content on that site.
I think I pitched it and yeah, I think she took it. I mean, not like right. You know, it wasn't like she wrote back, you know, 20 seconds later and was like, I must have this, but
I must have this.
I must have it tomorrow. But no, I think it was like, yeah, I mean, I think I didn't have to, you know, press too hard. Maybe it'd be, you know, because I'd written the Latin freestyle one before that. And I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I think I was kind of surprised too, because there's, you know, very little ska content on Pitchfork, even now. I mean, I was so surprised that over the last year that there wasn't a, you know, Catbite review or like a We Are the Union review. I'm you know, shocked that those records didn't get covered.
Me too. I'm disappointed that all these outlets that were jumping on the Ska's Back articles weren't willing to actually review these new records.
Right.
And I was kind of, you know, the people that would interview me and push these articles, I would try to like suggest that to them, like, hey, you should really consider reviewing these records because there's a lot of good records coming out this year, not just Jeff's mm-hmm. album, but there's other ones, lesser known bands. And I think that they're totally worthwhile to be reviewed and, you know, and just inserted within the other styles that are already okay.
No.
And yeah. But no, so far, no.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think too, like there was a point that I think Mike Park said in one of those like trend pieces where he was saying that he thought that this like new crop of bands was actually doing a better job than the 90s bands of like talking about politics and talking about things that were going on. And I think that's right. And I think, you know, something like, you know, We Are the Union, like that, like that's an important record for, you know, conversations that like that we're having right now. And I think like it's a shame that people aren't sort of drawing attention to it, because yeah, that's a great band. It's a great record.
Definitely.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like all the bands that are getting sort of a little bit more attention are all good bands too. That's something that's like really cool to me. And I still have hope that it'll get a little bit more. It'll snowball a little bit more because they're all good bands, and I see them all having a lot of potential to make better records and to really sort of help to rehab the ska's reputation, I think.
Yeah, it'll be sort of interesting to see how it sort of plays out, because it's like, you know, I think a lot of people have said this, and I agree, like, I don't think you're going to see a sort of traditional, like, in fourth wave of ska where there's like another MTV Scatterday or anything like that.
Thank
God that's the case. But, you know, like, you're not, I mean, you know, I don't know if like you'll see a ska single in the top 40 again, but just because of the way the world is now, things are so fragmented, and, you know, but, so yeah, it'll be kind of, you know, I think these like next couple of years are going to be really interesting just to see how the genre kind of shapes up and how the public at large kind of responds to it. And, you know, I think it'll be kind of hard to tell even if it's like reaching beyond like ska Twitter, you know, just because like there aren't the same kind of metrics to kind of, I mean, I guess, you know, people coming out to shows, maybe that's the true test, is like when, you know, Cat Bite tours, like, are they going to draw all across the country? I certainly hope so, because, you know, they're amazing.
Like, I agree with you. There's not going to be a top 40 single in ska. I mean, it's possible, but it's very unlikely. But, you know, places like Pitchfork and some of these other outlets, I mean, they review stuff that is like obscure. And they're into like garage rock and some of the stuff. Like, I don't see why there isn't room for like a handful of ska records to be part of those, you know, offbeat genres that they cover.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause there are plenty of them that have absolutely no potential to be top 40 bands.
That's true. Yeah. They do like a lot of, you know, experimental techno and stuff, and like these things that you're like, who's going to actually be like reading, you know, 700 word reviews on this? Like it's gotta be getting fairly minimal clicks, but yeah, I think it just goes back to, you know, what we've been saying, the kind of lack of respect for it. And I just want to know when there's going to be the Sunday review for Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. That's what I want to know.
Yeah. If you're listening. Yeah.
Kenneth, is so the sound in the background that we're hearing is a storm?
Oh yeah, sorry. Can you hear the rain on my windows? Is that?
Yeah, I'm actually really digging it. I was wondering if we can just look at the timer. Can you? How close can you get to the window?
I can get very close.
Go stand by the window and let's just watch the counter for 30 seconds, starting now. I think that was good.
That was our moment of zen.
Thank you so much for listening to In Defense of Ska. If you haven't already, subscribe to my newsletter at aaroncarnes.substack.com. You will get episodes of the In Defense of Ska podcast and other content sent directly to your inbox. If you would like to order my book, In Defense of Ska, you can go to Amazon, request it at your favorite indie bookstore or library, or go to clashbooks.com. And on that note, we leave you by saying, Ska now more than ever. Thank you.